Man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
My best analysis now is not that it's just one national entity. Unfortunately, I think that global corporate interests, they've all realized that democracy is bad for business. And now that there are fewer and fewer walls between parliaments and congresses and corporate interests, there's a systematic effort around the world to make the planet good for business by suppressing or crushing democracy around the world. What I think these corporate interests have realized is that a country like Singapore, it has media, it has fashion, it has youth culture, it has consumerism. It just doesn't have any civil rights whatsoever, right? That's the ideal.
You're listening to episode 710 of Unwelcome Guests, The Simplicity of the Singapore Model. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard Amy Klein's summary of the Singapore model as she sees it, a kind of corporate utopia, a world in which individual consumers don't have any illusions about potential power or decision-making capacities, but willingly subject themselves to the rules made up by their corporate overlords. This is part three in our series, which faces the failing culture of control. We looked last time at those evil twins, nuclear power and nuclear weapons, which have been such a cash cow to the military-industrial complex, and which arose from fear of individual nation-states and the desire to put into practice that logic which says we are the good guys, they are the bad guys, therefore we have a mission to eradicate them by any means possible. That logic, taken to its extreme, one might perhaps summarize as destroying the world to save it, and until nuclear weapons have been eradicated from the face of the earth, it seems to me that there is a very real possibility that that may happen. Now, this week we're broadening out our focus, looking at the fact that conflicts between nation states, whilst they're still important factors in people's minds and they dominate public discourse and world politics, if what we've been learning about the deep state is in fact true, then a good proportion of them are in fact no more than orchestrated distractions from the real action, often on another plane altogether. Is it right and fair that a few should be able to dictate terms to the many, as our economic system would seem to indicate? If that's not right, then what would be a sensible way to try to bring this current state of affairs to an end? Thinking, for example, about how quickly the Occupy Wall Street movement went global, because people, language barriers, other differences notwithstanding, realized that they had a common cause, and the concerns of a lot of people in any part of the world were de facto, therefore, their concerns. Now, this thought springs from what Charles Eisenstein refers to as the new story, not that Charles Eisenstein came up with it. And just for a quick Martin Luther King vibe, he it was who observed that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, and that true compassion means more than flinging a coin to a beggar. True compassion comes to see the whole Jericho Road must be changed. Now, in the 10 years that I've been quoting that to people and promoting fundamental economic reform, I've seen a shift from people who generally not really getting what on earth I'm talking about to people absolutely getting it and seeing that underneath a myriad of other surface issues is the unelected power of a very small group put into practice through the economic system with no claims to moral or other justification needed, and that unless we change how money works, we have made no substantive changes to the system. Now, for our first speaker, this is Naomi Wolf speaking on the Global Research News Hour from March 2015.
She is a former political consultant and a well-known feminist author following the publication of her 1991 classic, The Beauty Myth, which launched her reputation as a spokesperson for third-wave feminism. A few years after the 9/11 attacks, however, she started to become more reflective on the way civil liberties in the U.S. were being breached, and in 2007 published the provocative book, The End of America, Letter of Warning to a Young Patriot. In the book and subsequent talks, she outlines how there is a formula by which free societies close down and democracy shift into fascism, and that this approach is composed of 10 steps. She has commented on the signs of a fascist shift in the United States, and in light of the developments in Canada over the last 10 years, and particularly the recent anti-terrorism legislation being introduced in the House of Commons, we wanted to see if there's evidence of this fascist shift taking place north of the 49th parallel. Ms. Wolf has graciously agreed to join us by phone from New York. Hello, Naomi Wolf.
Hi, Michael.
So, could I ask you maybe briefly what got you on this trajectory of moving from feminist analysis to this concern about civil liberties and as they are taking place in real time?
Sure. It may seem at first glance as if they're different fields, but in fact, to me, they're very much the same mission, the same continuum. I mean, feminism is basically properly understood. It's just a logical extension of democracy. And the fight, I mean, feminism is often misdefined as a lifestyle issue or a, you know, gender war, but really, to me, it's best defined in these sort of classic Enlightenment terms of people just joining the universal fight for human rights, equality, and dignity, and representation and freedom. And so when you look at it in that light, it's natural that when I began to notice a systematic attack on civil liberties in the United States, and as the daughter of Holocaust survivors, I especially noticed in about 2006, 2007, and wrote about it, as you mentioned, in 2008 in The End of America, echoes of techniques that were historically established by totalitarian or fascist dictatorships on the left and on the right in the 30s and 40s and 50s of the last century, it would be a natural thing for me to want to raise the alarm about. And I should just say, you know, getting right into it, that unfortunately, and I'm so sorry to have to say this, I hope to the widest possible audience in Canada, unfortunately, the exact same techniques that we saw that suppressed our civil liberties and chipped away at our freedoms or slashed away at our freedoms in the United States are being enacted sort of step by step, technique by technique in Canada.
Okay. And just before we get into that, I just wanted to maybe get a sense that you've had a lot of time to reflect on this, but that this formula, that this consistent pattern that you see in all of the different regimes that you've surveyed, is it your impression that these people they're all reading from some classic guide, or is it simply a question of a shift, any entity wanting control, maybe it's because of the nature of human society or human psychology, by maybe, accident or otherwise, it will tend to have these characteristics? Or are they actually reading each other? Like, maybe Stephen Harper's reading the Mussolini's thing, or, George Bush is reading Fascism for Dummies or whatever.
Right. I mean, so you're asking a very, very important question. I'm going to slightly restate what I heard you asking, because I think it's really important for people to grasp this. You're basically saying, rightly, is it orchestrated and coordinated and deliberate, or is it just a movement of history, part of the pendulum, you know, swinging? And I, you know, hoped, obviously, that it was the latter, because then we would just be going through kind of a dark period and people would wake up. You know, if it surely couldn't be that democracy after democracy around the world was showing the same pattern. And when I first wrote The End of America, I really thought it was just America. You know, I thought, like, who's behind it? And what is it? And my best guess at that time was that it was the vast profits that could be made by extending war forever, wars of choice, at a time of peace and prosperity, and especially at a time historically when all those profits are threatened, because after the end of the Cold War, we don't have an obvious enemy. And the internet brings everyone so close together that humanity was really in danger of living in peace, you know, forever, or realizing that they could work things out or that they weren't so different. Technology was enabling that. And so, you know, my analysis in 2008 was that warmongers in the U.S. needed to create or hype terror threats in order to keep the profits rolling in. But unfortunately, I have to tell you, and I'm, again, I hate being Cassandra. I hate being the bearer of this kind of news. It does appear to be orchestrated and coordinated. And here's the evidence. We're seeing the exact same thing happen in advanced democracy after advanced democracy around the world. In other words, it started with 9/11. And, you know, the Patriot Act in the United States. And then we had surveillance. And then we had Blackwater, now called Academy, now called Z. And then we had the war on whistleblowers. And then we had the militarization of the police and, you know, each of these 10 steps toward fascism that I identify in the United States. But what we're seeing is that there are high-profile attacks taking place around the world. And as a former political consultant, I really want to stress there can be real crises that are then hyped or exploited or used for a directed political agenda. In other words, it doesn't have to be fake to be utilized or exploited, right? And so we're seeing this pattern in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand, in now Tunisia, which wasn't an advanced democracy, but, you know, we're seeing the same thing happen in the United States, in Britain, in France, in the Netherlands, in Norway, in Denmark, that there will be a crisis, and then you'll have this exact same legislation rushed through, which is a version of the Patriot Act. And again, as a former political consultant, I can tell you these bills are hard to create. They take a long time. They're, you know, scores of pages, if not hundreds of pages long. And so it seems disturbing to me that advanced democracies around the world had these same bills and laws, and you're dealing with this right now in Canada. Thank God you're trying to fight it, you know, ready in waiting. Like, the way it's narrated in each country is, oh my God, crisis. We have to have a reaction, and the reaction is this set of laws. But in fact, those laws don't arise overnight. They don't arise in reaction, you know, chronologically to a crisis or a terror attack. They are long planned, take long execution. And then we see the exact same thing happen after that. We see global surveillance, global, you know, after the Snowden revelations about the United States telecom surveillance, we see revelations, pardon me, of intelligence agencies in Britain, in Germany, in France, in the Netherlands, in Israel, you know, in Canada, in New Zealand, in Australia, disclosing that they're surveilling citizens. You see the same harassment of activists ratcheting up, the same brutal militarized police. You see the same uniforms, this sort of horrific robotic, you know, body armor, black, face covered, helmeted, militarized policing look in advanced democracies around the world that are supposed to be peaceful civil societies where you know, citizens aren't supposed to be arrested violently for freedom of assembly. You see, you know, the militarization of police forces in democracies around the world. Yeah, you're seeing the exact same patterns. And so my best analysis now is not that it's just one national entity. My best analysis, do you want me to give you my best analysis? Because it's a bummer.
Okay.
I mean, I guess at this point I have to tell you what my best analysis is. Unfortunately, I think that global corporate interests, mostly the war industry, but especially now the vast profits that are being realized by surveillance technologies, vast, like billions, but also the other four global industries that increasingly run everything, which I think of as, in the United States, big insurance, you don't have that issue, but big pharma, big agriculture, big oil, right? They've all realized that democracy is bad for business and that really corporations, global corporations, flourish best in a climate like China, which is all about consumerism, but no one has civil rights. And so there is a, I believe, systematic, you know, effort. And now that there are fewer and fewer walls between parliaments and congresses and corporate interests, there's a systematic effort around the world to make the planet good for business by suppressing or crushing democracy around the world.
So for these global power players, China is the promised land?
You know, have you ever heard the expression the Singapore model?
I think so, yeah.
Thing. It's a thing. So I was in Singapore recently. Singapore is even better than China because they don't have any ideology. Like, China still nominally has communism. And what I think these corporate interests have realized is that a country like Singapore, which has, you know, it has media, it has fashion, it has youth culture, it has consumerism, it just doesn't have any civil rights whatsoever, right? That's the ideal.
Now, turning our attention back to the Canadian, specifically to the Canadian example, as I mentioned, you've boiled it down to 10 basic steps. I think you've already mentioned a couple of them, invoking an external and internal threat. I don't think anyone can question that the Harper government has been doing that in Canada, as well as surveillance of ordinary citizens. There are a couple more we could mention. Establish secret prisons, develop a paramilitary force, infiltrate citizen groups, arbitrarily detain and release citizens. Do you see any of those being implemented in Canada at present?
I do, and probably there's a lot more that I don't see because the mainstream media has been very good at not shining a light on some of the most egregious and newsworthy stories. But yeah, well, I obviously the anti-terror laws that are going to be so catastrophic for Canada, you know, and the protests about them are in the news right now. But I think that you've got, okay, here's one. I was shocked to discover that the United States has a law that was passed that allows the U.S. to police in Canada. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Mm-hmm.
DHS has an agreement with Canada. It involves border policing. But it's not just about joint policing at the border. It's also about U.S. policing inside of Canada. I mean, I was, you know, this is one of those laws that you just think if Canadians knew this, they would be up in arms. It's so dangerous. And, you know, you guys are not as far along the road of, you know, the journey to fascism, you know, fortunately for you, then we are down here, so you might not think, or many people listening might think, well, what's so bad about that? But what we see in the United States is with the Department of Homeland Security, which is responsible for this whatever arrangement, taking over more and more domestic civil society police functions, right? You're not supposed to have military policing in a free democracy. You're supposed to have civil policing because they're answerable to the police commissioner, which is answerable to the elected official.
Posse comitatus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what we saw in the United States is coordination of Department of Homeland Security over-policing, militarization of police forces, and then a kind of global crackdown in November of 2011. violent crackdown against Occupy protesters in 12 cities across America, violent arrests, you know, injuries, damaging arrests, terrifying arrests, 10-year sentences, you know, complete breaking of this movement. And so, you know, Canada should worry about the militarization of policing. I definitely see it, you know, like in G20 and I believe Vancouver, you are definitely seeing in Canada the kind of violent provocateurs infiltrating peaceful citizens groups and creating violence as an excuse to crack down on protesters and arrest protesters.
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you brought that up because at the G20, there were over 1,000 arrests. It was the largest mass arrest in Canadian history.
Yeah.
And I mean, there was a lot of criticism of how the brutality used by the police services, and there were thousands of police, military, and security personnel involved in those protests.
There were military involved in the protests in Canada. That's very
involved
serious.
In the policing. Yeah,
in the policing. I'm horrified to hear that. That's extremely serious. And
yeah.
I'm sure you know why. You know, the definition of a police state is that the military engages in civil policing. It may seem nice if you don't have a tradition of posse comitatus like we do in the United States, separating civil and military policing, you know, when they're rescuing pets from a flood, but, you know, when they start occupying cities or suspending the rule of law, it, you know, or declaring a state of emergency, it's much less nice. I mean, once you let the cat out of the bag with military policing civil society, you have a police state. There's something else I'm thinking about in Canada, which is very serious. We're seeing the same narrative of lockdown in country after country. And here's what I mean by that. You had a sniper situation, right? Was it Ontario or near Ontario?
It was in Ottawa.
Ottawa.
There was a lone individual who was supposedly inspired by ISIS, went into the Canadian House of Commons, that's like the capital of Canada. And he had, well, before making it into the House of Commons, he had shot somebody at the War Memorial, soldier. So this,
So it's terrible, of course. But here's what I want to just narrate with some distress. The same news story virtually unfolded in Sydney, Australia. You know, a very similar news story in Paris, France. You had this guy in Ottawa, and there's this lone gunman narrative or this sort of ISIS-inspired narrative unfolding around the world. It may all be true. It may be that there are just a bunch of guys going crazy all at once and engaging in pretty much the same news story all at once. That just may be authentically happening. However, what disturbs me as a journalist is that very few questions are asked about these stories by journalists as they're unfolding. So we found out, for instance, in Sydney, it was described by news sources at the time as an ISIS-inspired individual, and then it turned out the guy had absolutely nothing to do with ISIS. It was just kind of a crazy Muslim guy. But that narrative was already out there. And then that narrative, the ISIS narrative, is a very worrying one because all of the democracies are using this narrative of Canadians going to join ISIS, Americans going to join ISIS, French people going to join ISIS, as an excuse to suspend travel freedom, crack down on passports, engage in, you know, preventive arrests, criminalize thought, right? They're arresting people not for doing things, but for thinking things, which is always the nose in the, you know, camel's nose in the tent kind of thing. Like today, ISIS, tomorrow, dissidents, activists, environmentalists. And so the other thing, so I'm worried that journalists aren't asking questions about these weirdly identical, weirdly useful. I'm not saying they didn't happen. I'm just saying journalists aren't doing their jobs, right? And when questions are being asked, there are a lot of anomalies. For instance, my community, Daily Kraut, reported out carefully, and I got in a lot of trouble for saying, you know, by media outlets for asking normal journalistic questions about the ISIS hostage videos, right? In October, November, there were these terrible, terrible videos of, you know, hostages getting ready to be beheaded. And all I said was, you know, these are single-sourced. Journalism teaches you to have two sources independently confirming each other before you publish something as a fact. And they were sourced from one entity with close ties to the U.S. government and the anti-terror establishment, which is a group called SITE, S-I-T-E. They get $500,000 in 2004 from the U.S. government. And all I said as a journalist was good journalism would submit these videos to independent analysis and verification. And I was savagely attacked in multiple outlets for saying that. It's what the New York Times did with the Watergate tapes. You know, any important piece of audio or video that you're going to go to war on, you know, or report as accurate, good journalism independently verifies it. So having been viciously attacked about this, it turns out that two future or later hostage stories fell apart when my community of citizen journalists reported them out and checked. One of them was actually based in Montreal. Allegedly, a Montreal woman journalist was allegedly held by ISIS. And when we reported it out, it turned out that the Montreal news site said she didn't work there, and that the origin of the story was Doha, with a base with a British security, private security firm, and the image that they were using was the Swedish sportscaster. So the whole thing completely fell apart. So there's fake news entering the news stream for a lot of interesting reasons. The rise of private security companies that are hired to, you know, feed fake news into the news stream. Certainly intelligence agencies are routinely tasked with black propaganda, feeding fake news into the news stream overseas. Why should we be surprised that in a global news environment there are stories entering the news stream that don't check out or that fall apart, but journalists aren't doing their jobs?
And let me just, because that's a good segue to the next question I had with regard to this, is that you probably wouldn't be aware of this, but the day before the Canadian House of Commons voted on this anti-terrorism legislation, it was on a Sunday, and all day long you were seeing this news reporting, like every half hour they were showing these images of some fellow with a white hood. It was supposedly somebody from Al Shabaab was encouraging people to attack Canadian places, including the West Edmonton Mall. And
right.
That was running all day, the timing just before the anti-terrorism legislation. Does that echo anything that you've encountered through your research?
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up and you brought me back to the point, which is fake news is entering the news stream. And the goal of the fake news is to keep advanced democracies in a state of fear, constant fear, but especially fear right before a useful bill can be passed. And the goal, as I mentioned before, is to turn Canada into Singapore, to turn the United States into Singapore, to turn Britain into Singapore, to turn France into Singapore, so that, you know, your pipeline can be laid with no opposition, your black tar sands can be exploited with no opposition, your environment can be laid waste with no opposition, and business can just take over Canada, basically, with no opposition. And so, absolutely, I don't know that this was a fake clip. I do know that there are a number of similar clips being played around the clock in the United States, in Britain, in Australia, New Zealand, right before a bill needs to go through. And the journalists don't ask very basic questions. There was a video recently that got a lot of play of 20 Christians being beheaded by ISIS. And they may well have been beheaded by ISIS, and I don't mean to trivialize the atrocities committed by ISIS, but Fox News subjected this clip to an independent analysis, and it turned out that it was staged and color corrected to turn the waves into blood, and that a person who worked in special effects said these are really ridiculous special effects. So that clip played over and over and over again right before the president of the United States got authorization to use military force in Iraq, which meant, you know, more billions of dollars, unaccountable tax dollars, flowing into the coffers of Raytheon, Halliburton, private industry involved in the war machine. So, you know, yeah, you should ask those questions, because let me tell you, as an American, I love Canada. I love, love, love Canada. When I go north of the border, I feel like I'm in a sane version of what America could have been if we hadn't lost our minds. And one of the things I love about Canada is it's peaceful and rational. And if now you too, which seems obvious, are being bombarded with this fear propaganda, this terror hype, this inflation of the threat, these constant replays of threat, 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 you're targeted, you're targeted, without journalists asking any good questions about where these clips are coming from or who sourced them or how the news got them or how they know they're accurate, then unfortunately you're heading into the very awful psychological reality we inhabit down here of being in a constant state of fear and anxiety, constantly manipulated and having lost our rights.
Okay, I know you're very tight on time right now. I just have like maybe I'm going to try to package two questions into one, if I may, and then you can address both of them or either of them. First of all, I was curious to know because it seems to me that all of the examples you've studied are all patriarchal society. So I was wondering if there was maybe a gendered aspect to this shift into fascism. Of course, you mentioned the thugs, but I was wondering if there were anything else along those lines. But also, I had the question about what fascist Canada would look like. I mean, we've seen depictions of the police state in movies and popular culture. Would we be surprised by what a fully fascist Canada should this...
Those words make me so sad. I love Canada so much. So let me just transition by actually saying what I had wanted to say about a specific example of police state Canada. So when this sniper was loose, or allegedly loose, because all you have are the police, you know, I'm guessing that no journalist actually independently got any direct confirmation of the story at all, because journalists have stopped doing that. It's all transcription from the police or the security services or the parliament or the president or the prime minister. But one of the disturbing things was that this town was in lockdown, right? And you're seeing this a lot. You saw it in California, you're seeing it in France, lockdown. Well, I grew up in Israel during a time, and in often in Britain as well, during periods where there was a lot of real terrorism. And there was never lockdown. Like, there would be, if there was, God forbid, a terrorist situation, when I was growing up, the tactic was to get everyone out of there, not to, quote, shelter in place, or to lock down a town or a neighborhood, or tell people not to go outside. And what I'm really worried about is that around the world, you're seeing these stories of, oh, sniper loose, lockdown. The reason I worry about that is I feel that we're being conditioned, and we're having drills in U.S. schools, elementary schools, of the whole school being trained to lock down children every month. I mean, crazy money is going into this in the United States. And the reason I worry about it is it's conditioning citizens to blindly obey authority. And then all you have to do, if you really want to kind of take over a civil society, is create a crisis or declare a crisis or an emergency. And then you have all these people basically going where they're told or doing what they're told without questioning. And so I guess when you're asking what does Canada as a police state look like, it looks like that neighborhood in lockdown where people are told you have to blindly obey because there's fear. And we know it's best for you. It would be fine if we could trust the government would never use fear against us. But unfortunately, Harper is using fear against you Canadians, just like Bush and Obama and really the people pulling their strings, who are the six industries that increasingly run everything, are using fear to strip us of our freedom of thought, freedom of resistance, freedom of assembly, freedom of dissent.
Well, Naomi Wolf, you've been very gracious with your time. I'm very pleased to have finally gotten the chance to interview you. Thank you very much for agreeing to this interview.
Thank you so much. And on a happier note, I trust the Canadians, my respect and adore, to rise up in time and fight back and reclaim the
I looked at the other. He was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking. They didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you want to be the president, better learn to salute and be a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. If a single one of them are in cahoots, he's running the U.S., Europe, and Russia too. White man in a business suit. I got rejected for a loan at the financial institute by a white, white white man in a business suit. I tried talking to my congressman, he didn't give a hoot. He was a white man in a business suit. I went to see my preacher, he just asked me to contribute. He was a white man in a business suit. They finally hauled me to a shrink, he said my cape was a cute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, there's a whole lot of things I'd rather do than be a white man in a business suit. I'd rather be ragged with holes in my shoes than be a white man in a business suit. Yeah!
Now we continue with the following interview from December 2011. We hand over to Peter B. Collins, interviewer for the Boiling Frogs Post.
Andrew Gavin Marshall, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
I've had a chance to review some of your writings and take a look at your website. And in your own biography, one of the things that it focuses on is that you like to look at power, how power is developed. You talk about analyzing the structures and nature of power, how it is built and used, mm-hmm. by whom, for what, and what the historical conditions are. Give us a sense of your worldview in terms of the work that you do, trying to look at particularly the contemporary power structure in the world.
All right. Well, essentially, I look at the ideas and institutions of power. And with that, you have to look at, of course, individuals who hold power. But whether you are born a Rockefeller or born a little pleb, peasant person, you are a product of that society, and therefore you are a product of the ideas and institutions of power which make up that society. While the individuals can come up with ideas, create institutions, it's much easier for the institutions and ideas to shape the individuals themselves. So fundamentally, while I recognize that there's a lot in critical media and literature, there's a lot of focus on the specific elites personally. I don't shy away from naming names or going over personal biographies and histories, but I try to understand the root causes, because all these dominant families, dynastic influences, elites in general, are still themselves a product of this system. So I seek to understand how that system came to be itself. Essentially, I look at how ideas, whether good, benevolent, bad, oppressive, how they become institutionalized. So the founding of an institution to represent a particular idea, as institutions are structured hierarchically, the ideas become a part of that structure. And even if they start off benevolent, they become corrosive and corrupting. And so I look generally at the global system as a type of institution itself. There was a radical sociologist in the 60s named Irving Goffman who wrote a book on asylums and studied the nature of institutions, and what he is specifically psychiatric institutions. What he discovered was that this concept called institutionalization, where the inmate within an asylum is a product of the asylum more than they are of their own, you can call it a disease, a method of living, etc., problems with the mind, madness, but that often the madness was itself a product of being within the institution. So that first, in order to free the individual, you had to break down the institution.
Mm-hmm.
So I apply this concept to a global understanding, that we have so many overlapping institutions and ideas of empire, power, states, banks, corporations, think tanks, foundations, universities, media, etc. And they interact, they're interdependent, they have overlapping leadership, they create a sort of octopus with its arms stretched out across the world, but this sort of institutional being which creates, controls, seeks to define humanity and human nature, and force people to conform to the system that it dictates. And so, you know, you hear people often saying that you know, humanity always needs to have some sort of authority in order to keep us from killing each other, to keep order, to prevent chaos, to preserve the peace. Well, we've been living under these institutions and systems for so long, but all we have is chaos. All we have is murder. All we have is war and oppression. So clearly, that isn't very logical. Instead, I personally view a system whereby people, essentially humanity, matures. We're still in our sort of adolescent stage where, you know, the parents tell the children what to wear, where to go to school, what jobs they should get, et cetera, give them their lunch and send them out for the day. But now it's time that humanity just grows up and starts determining its own path. And so to do that, we have to sort of break down this institutional structure, both internally, so challenging the ideas, and most of all, your own ideas, your personal ideas, but also challenging the institutions that dominate us. So creating new alternatives, new things to give power to people. I tend to bring up this analogy a lot in my writing, where in terms of understanding a view of human nature, where people generally say human nature is violent, human nature is reactionary, etc. But it's hard to make these kind of statements if we haven't really been allowed to be free and experience what our human nature is. It's like a scientist studying mice in a maze. He can make all these claims about the mouse and the mice and their nature and reality, but he cannot understand the mouse outside of the context of the maze. So if you break down all the walls of the maze, suddenly you will have an entirely new mouse, and you'll have to redefine its nature. Essentially, that's my view of the world, that we have to start breaking down these barriers which define, control, oppress, and then start to figure out what it is we are actually capable of and what we can create from that, because the potential of a blank slate is unlimited. And I think that for all of human history, seeing these bursts of creativity, ingenuity, and incredible individuals and ideas coming through, if those things can come through this system, that just shows the power of human potential itself. So I think it's time that we just sort of create a system, a community, an idea of the world which is shaped around human nature instead of trying to conform human nature to our social reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, my ideas are just revolved around exposing, trying to understand the social reality and how we can move beyond it.
Andrew Gavin Marshall, if I may ask, I'd like you to give us a bit of a reality check, because you have an interesting perspective as a non-American who's not immersed in the United States and in our corporate media culture. There is this notion of American exceptionalism. And it drives many different urges and policies in the United States, and it also drives a kind of passivity of the American public accepting what our government and our leaders put forward. And in your comments a few minutes ago, you referenced dynasty and empire. And those are two concepts that are very real in American culture, yet quite foreign to the average American. They don't recognize dynasty. They don't see the Clinton-Bush exchange at the top of our government. And they don't really see, or at least it's not readily apparent, the handoff of wealth from one generation of the uber-wealthy to the next and the power that goes with that. So take a minute or two, and no politeness or political correctness, be as blistering as you care to, about the American perspective as it relates to our own role in the world.
Okay. Well, I'm with George Carlin on this one when he said that it's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe in it.
I love that line.
And I think that's... it's an incredible line, and leave it to a brilliant comedian to come up with it. But there's a lot of truth in that. And it's this idea that's generally held on. And even among, you know, sort of the the major upsurge in an anti-New World Order movement in the United States, it's still very much nationalistic, in many ways pro-capitalist, and it holds on to these ideas of American exceptionalism, and that personally I find to be its major flaw, because this isn't an American problem. This isn't a Canadian problem. This isn't even a Western problem. This is a human problem. This is a human reality. And the idea of the nation states and patriotism and these types of things, these are historical fiction. They're, you can't touch a state. You can't the boundaries, the borders, they exist on maps, but there's no line going through the world. There's no These are generally fictions that are just accepted. And what I find on the part of a lot of American ideas and these types of things is that they're based sort of upon a myth of what America was, but never actually was. So it's the idea that you hear a lot of, we need to go back to our roots. And indeed, there were progressions, particularly with the American Revolution and the Constitution. These are, I think, incredible steps forward, but there's more steps to take. It's no, I reject the idea of going back to anything, precisely, first of all, because those ideas are usually based upon going back to a myth, not a reality. So while the American Revolution produced the Constitution, which was largely borrowed from actually American indigenous peoples, it still, the American society that was created was not a utopia. It did not benefit all people. Women and black Americans, they didn't have any rights. The governments that came continued to expand westwards in an imperialistic fashion, wiping out native communities. Eventually they expanded down into the Americas, overtly imperialistic with the Monroe Doctrine in, I believe, 1828. Establishing that South America is ours. So all these ideas, you know, they didn't create a utopia. Within America, there was massive labor unrest throughout the 19th century as the what were called the robber barons, so the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Vanderbilts, the Astors, etc., all these industrialist and banking families rose up to power with the American Industrial Revolution. And the people, the workers, laborers, underclass, were rising up, increasingly radicalized, even revolutionary movements, a lot of socialists, communists, anarchists, etc. But there was no utopia that ever existed. And then, so a lot of what I hear today from even, you know, alternative media and such is that, you know, the problem was that the Federal Reserve was created in 1913. And that is sort of the idea that that is the root of all the problems, and if we just get rid of that, everything will be solved and we'll go back to our utopia. And that's sort of, again, an American exceptionalism type of idea, because the central banking system started much further back beyond that in 1694 in London with the Bank of England. And it's, you have to go back to the roots. Like the word radical itself, the Latin means to get to the root of. So the idea of radical ideas is to get to the root of the problem, to go back to history to learn, but not to try and move backwards. So we have to pick up these lessons and move forward with them and sort of get rid of these ideas which are based on myths. We won't move forward if we're trying to move into some sort of fiction. We have to see the world for what it is, understand our histories for what they are. You don't have to be ashamed of the history, but you have to learn from it so that you can progress.
Well, thanks for joining us today, because that'll never happen. The American media won't permit it. And it was really nice talking with you.
Well, that's not what the American media is there for. That's not what any media is there for. Canadian media is no better. And in fact, they're actually more concentrated in corporations than the U.S. media. We have less than a handful of corporations here which dominate the near entire nation's media.
You do have a government media, though, that at least looks good from here.
Yes. Well, it's sort of like the equivalent of the BBC. It's the CBC and Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And compared to the corporate media, it's a wonderful bastion of information. But compared to reality, it's still just a propaganda outlet.
But my perception, even of the commercial Canadian media, is that it doesn't reinforce the nationalism or exceptionalism that is rampant in America.
No, that's very true. And you don't get that a lot with several European media as well. And I think this is fundamentally because America was selected. It wasn't an accident. It was selected to be the global empire. And so to do so, just like in Rome, just like in Britain, and in all empires, you have to foster a national identity, a strict patriotism which promotes the empire. And the American empire is an empire in self-denial. The imperialists themselves, the strategists, the people who run the show, they know it's an empire. They don't often use those specific words, though. Some of them, like my favorite strategist to study, Zbigniew Brzezinski. He is very overt in his language at times and comes out to say, yes, we're an empire and we control the world, etc. But for the American population, unlike the Romans and unlike the British before them, before the Americans, that is, there's no acknowledgement of empire. It's sort of the idea that we don't go around the world exerting our hegemony, dominating people, oppressing them, spreading war, controlling populations, extracting their resources for our own corporate and banking benefits. That's not an acknowledged perception among the general population. The general population views America as spreading freedom and democracy around the world, leading by example, helping people.
We are the good guys.
Exactly. You know, it's like, yes, we don't do everything perfectly.
They hate our freedom.
Yeah, well, exactly, and so obviously we need to dismantle our freedoms so that they'll have nothing left to hate. I guess that's the logic.
Hey, we're working on it.
Oh, we certainly are. We
made a lot of progress.
Oh, yeah, and Canada is trying to catch up, and it's just that America is the hegemon, so it's more necessary that its population is more indoctrinated with such ideas of patriotism, blind faith. You know, wave the flag and people will go to sleep. And I think it was Upton Sinclair who said that when fascism comes to America, it'll be wrapped in the flag and carrying a cross. And it's sort of like that type of idea. You need to, and this is, fascist governments, imperial governments, they always have the flag. It's always patriotism for king and country type of ideas. But it's,
sure.
It's more necessary
security
in the United States.
It's homeland. It's the fatherland, motherland. Those were the terminology always attached to the police states.
Absolutely, and homeland
Act.
Security.
Patriot Act. I mean, how could you vote against it?
Of course.
You would be very unpatriotic.
Exactly. It's all, language has so much to do with it. It's fascinating to see how it's employed, but Orwell just must be spinning in his grave.
He's just wishing he could collect royalties for all this.
Oh, yeah. They're masters at doublespeak and promoting doublethink, and it's impressive to see, but it's disturbing to understand.
Now, Andrew, Poppy Bush, George H.W. Bush, was the second of the trio of elected Bushes from that dynasty. His father was a senator, and his son somehow became president. And he introduced the phrase New World Order during the time of his invasion of Kuwait and part of Iraq in what was called Operation Desert Storm. And nobody in the United States really ever knew what he meant by New World Order because he never actually defined what he meant. And so it was left for people to kind of make their own interpretations. The ideas were advanced by the Project for a New American Century, PNAC, that surfaced in the late 1990s and appeared to create the blueprint for George W. Bush's expansive ideas. So I'd like to ask you first to explain your idea of New World Order and then to describe it in terms of the changes in the Middle East attributed to the so-called Arab Spring.
All right. Well, the New World Order, I looked at, in my book, I have a whole chapter on this, and I look at it a lot from the perspective of what the academic literature reflected at the time, particularly in political science, because as soon as George Bush used the phrase, everybody started talking about it. It was in the think tank community, as you said, with Project for New American Century. They took that concept, sort of created their own vision of it and went with that. But all the think tanks came up with ideas for a new world order. Essentially, the consensus on the view within the American establishment was that the Soviet Union had fallen. So communism was no longer the boogeyman that you could go around conquering the world as an excuse to go around conquering the world. So the idea was that America was now the single global power. So the New World Order was the idea of a unipolar, essentially, world order, where there was one power dominant over the entire world. And the aim, of course, would be to maintain and expand that dominance. So this obviously requires military adventurism, expansionism, war, empire. That's why it's very significant that Bush Sr. gave this speech declaring the start of a new world order upon the beginning of the Iraq War, you know, because the first war that was waged by the United States without the excuse of communism was actually the Panama invasion. But the excuses were sort of all over the map, and it was a little difficult to define accurately what the purpose was, at least for the public. But Iraq was truly that sort of starting point in the sense that now we need to dominate the resources, okay? So now we need an extreme military presence in the Middle East, invade Iraq, put the bases in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, et cetera. That was a symbol to other potential rivals, China, for example, or a possible resurgent Russia, as to the fact that the United States is going to control the world's resources. And the other facet of the New World Order is one of promoting ideas of global governance. So not just America in charge of the world, but America actively helping to construct a new system of governance itself. Because the elite, which are not just American, they are essentially a transnational group. They don't believe in nations. They see themselves as internationalists, essentially, and not in terms of international solidarity for people over the world, but just for them. And they don't really want to see the rising up of a new empire in the sense of another country becoming an empire and running the world. They'd rather create a more concrete system of global governance. Now, this is what Aldous Huxley was writing about in the 30s and again in the 50s and 60s, where he said that, you know, the 20th century will be the century of social engineers, social controllers, and the 21st century will be the century of world controllers. Now, he said that in 1961, and it was quite prescient, I think. And it's the idea that they are going to create a system of global governance whereby all nations and peoples will be governed under a single institutional structure, and that the American empire is essentially being used as an engine to push this process. This is a process that would not be possible without the American empire. After all, it created the World Bank, the IMF, the UN, NATO, etc., all these institutions which are part of this global governance apparatus. They are a result of the American empire. So they use it as an engine of empire for this new world order. But it also requires America to be increasingly militaristic and warmongering, because you need to get rid of all the barriers to this process. So take out the states that don't adhere to your monetary system, that aren't in your debt. Take out the states that present an alternative, a threat, which is why Yugoslavia had to be dismantled, because communism was over. You can't have a socialist state existing as a viable alternative, so it had to be dismantled. And that was, of course, Clinton throughout the 90s affected that process. And so there's the ideas, from the Carnegie Endowment, where Madeleine Albright was situated for some time in the early 90s. They came up with ideas of how to promote the New World Order, and they came up with the idea of let's promote humanitarian intervention. which, of course, we are seeing again. And it's the idea that in the New World Order,